above zero.
Major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants. Since 1985, offering discerning patients and dentists options for same-day replacement of missing and compromised teeth. Information online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Remarkably, given the number of teams with mediocre records that squeezed into the NFL playoffs, none of the clubs still in contention for the Super Bowl has won fewer than 12 games or lost more than five. Tomorrow afternoon, the 13-4 Tampa Bay Buccaneers will face the 13-4 Philadelphia Eagles for the NFC Championship. Tomorrow evening, the 12-5 Tennessee Titans will meet the 12-5 Oakland Raiders for the AFC title. Joining me now from his bunker in Virginia to prepare us all for the action is Paul Attner, who writes about football for the Sporting News. Hello again, Paul.
Hey, Bill. Thank you. It gives me an opportunity to come out and see some light for a change here.
Excellent. Philadelphia beat the Buccaneers when they played earlier this season, and in fact, the Eagles also won the previous three meetings between those two teams. How much does this encourage the Eagles and discourage the Buccaneers?
I think a lot more certainly than Tampa's willing to admit. You got to throw in cold weather too, Bill. Tampa had this long string of not being able to win in really cold weather. They broke it against a terrible Bears team, which this year, which means nothing as far as I'm concerned. So we're talking about going into an environment that where they can't win, haven't won in the past. And going to be really chilly. And I don't think any of that works in their favor. And they know, they can't make bad plays and they can't make mistakes. And the more they think about it, the more they start pressing and all that kind of human nature works against them too. So it's really going to be very difficult, I think, for Tampa to overcome all those different elements.
But I don't understand it. It's not like all the players on the Tampa team come from Tampa. I mean, they come from places like Pittsburgh and New England and all over Michigan, all over the place, just like every other team.
Well, Bill, when you go on vacation, it takes you, one day to forget how cold it could be up where you are. So, and I think that's the Tampa experience. There is something to it, Bill, seriously, about practicing in it and being involved in cold every day versus walking off a plane when it's been 78 degrees where you just came from and all of a sudden it's 20. Mm-hmm. And I do really think there is a factor there. And now it's gotten into their psyche. I mean, they get told so much that they can't win that I think that affects them too.
Since tomorrow's Eagles-Bucks contest will be the final game at venerable Veterans Stadium, as they say, arguably the worst venue in the NFL now that Foxborough Stadium has been replaced, I'd like to invite you to share fond memories of the place, if you have any.
Let me count the number of times I've been stuck in the one lousy elevator they've got coming up, or the beer that you walk in, or you're sitting at your seat and you're sitting in just a puddle of water, or having the water above you dripping on your head, or the wind just blowing through the press box, or watching the cops beat up people. I mean, I see that almost every time I'm up there. They're drunks and they just don't arrest them there. They beat them up and then arrest them. So it's a tough neighborhood, Bill, and it's one that you really don't want to go into very often.
Will it be any different when the Eagles have a new stadium, or is this a Philadelphia phenomenon no matter what the actual building looks like?
The cops come. The cops come with the new building. So I think the liquor may be served to people of higher income, but I have a feeling they can get drunk too. So I think that part doesn't change. I mean, the stadium, having been in the newer stadiums after suffering through the older ones, the newer stadiums attract a different type of crowd, I think. But ultimately, people misbehave no matter where. And in Philadelphia, that character is not going to change. They're going to be the same no matter if they're uptown or downtown. And it's always going to be unique going there.
On the AFC side, I love the fact that the Raiders have a cornerback who's 37 years old. I thought only kickers and quarterbacks played that long, but I gather Oakland has a number of guys ancient enough to remember not only George Bush the first, but Jimmy Carter.
They're getting Social Security checks prematurely there, I believe. But they've defied the logics of the league. The league says that you don't have a bunch of old players because supposedly they get tired in December. And that's what was going to happen with Oakland, that the Geritol bunch was going to run out of liquid and they were going to get old. It didn't happen. If anything, guys like Rod Woodson and Bill Romanowski, who are 35-plus, are playing maybe as well as they've ever played in their career. And it's another shine of their owner, Al Davis, showing everybody else that he can do it his way and be successful with it.
Paul, do enemies of excess and mayhem root against the Raiders and the Eagles tomorrow? These are two teams historically known for drunken, rampaging fans. Would it really be a good thing for football and for San Diego if they and their fans were to meet in the Super Bowl?
Do you think the San Diego police have a pool going? who we'd rather have. I think it would be a unique matchup of the Raider fans and the Eagle fans. And I was caught last week and trying to get to the Raiders game through a mass of fandom. It was the most bizarre bunch of cycles I've ever been involved in, and it was scary. It really was. I was very happy to reach my destination, but it would be. I think the days leading up to the game and the streets of San Diego might be as entertaining as the game itself.
This Super Bowl has the distinction of being the first one that will not be covered by Will McDonough, late of the Boston Globe and NBC. Mr. McDonough was 67 when he died a week ago on Thursday. The celebration of his career has been so extraordinary here in Boston. I wonder if it and he will be mentioned amid all the pomp and glitter in San Diego next week.
He certainly will be among the media, Bill. He was a legend. He was incredibly admired. He was a pioneer in our business. He did things and covered the NFL the way it had never been covered before, and really established new standards how you go about covering the league. I mean, talking to inside people, breaking news stories, that type of thing. And he made everybody become a lot more aggressive, and I think it reflects a higher standard of journalism for all of us. So certainly among his peers, he'll be remembered, and I'm sure there's going to be some type of ceremony out there at some point for him.
All right. Now, Paul, you have talked about how you think Tampa might have trouble in the weather in Philadelphia, but we don't actually have you on the record with a prediction, so it's time.
Every year, Bill. And you're nice about this. You never remind me of my bad predictions from year to year, and I appreciate that. But
I never remember them.
That's good, because I try not to. But Philadelphia, yes, I'm leaning towards them. I think it's going to be a close game, and I would not be surprised if Tampa won, but I think Philadelphia is a better team, so they should. And I think that Oakland is certainly superior to the Titans in the other game, and so I think that leaves you with an Oakland-Philadelphia Super Bowl.
Okay, so who's going to win the Super Bowl?
I've been persuaded this week in many phone conversations that the Raiders are the better of the two teams if that matchup occurs, or even if Oakland plays Tampa, that they should be able to beat both teams. And so I'm going to go with Oakland in the Super Bowl.
Paul Attner covers the NFL for the Sporting News, and he's our regular pro football analyst because we promise to forget all the predictions that he botches. Thank you, Paul.
Thank you, Bill.
There are nearly 70 foreign players from more than 35 countries currently playing in the National Basketball Association. Not one of them is from Iran. But as KPCC's Steve Julian reports, that hasn't stopped a Los Angeles radio station from becoming the first in the nation to broadcast NBA games in Farsi.
Slam dunk برگردون. من منتظر نمایش بودم چون خودش بود و خودش و خودش.
By day, Nick Zahab is an accountant, but on many nights you can hear him doing play-by-play for Lakers games. These games are carried on KIRN-AM, the only Farsi language station in the U.S. It serves Southern California's Iranian community, nearly a million strong. KIRN program director Hossein Hijazi points to the broadcasts as a way of linking the American and Iranian communities.
This was one of the things that I believe we were planning to do to make this bridge faster and faster.
Last year, KIRN's sister station, KWKW, had contracts to carry both Lakers and Dodgers games in Spanish. The Lakers' playoff run overlapped the start of the Dodgers season. And because KWKW was required by contract to broadcast every Dodgers game, general manager John Paley made the switch, and his listeners responded.
We had to carry three or four games in Spanish for our sister station. They said, fine, you want to run the Lakers, run it in Farsi.
So Paley tapped Nader Zatab as technician and color analyst and Nick Zahab to call the play-by-play.
All of my life I've been involved with numbers and the stats and all of that. How many points, how many rebounds, how many assists players have. And sometimes it's difficult and it's frustrating, but we get better and better every day.
Zahab was introduced to the NBA in his native Iran. He remembers watching the great Lakers center of the 1960s, Will Chamberlain, battle Bill Russell in the Boston Celtics. He believes Iranians appreciate hearing games in their native language, but admits not all basketball terms can be translated.
If it's a three-pointer, in Farsi, we call it the se-imtiazi. Exactly means three, and imtiaz means points. For slam dunk is a slam dunk, although we can say kubit tuye halqe, means press it hard into the net or into the basket. Certain things, we don't change it because it requires you make a sentence for it, so, and we avoid that.
Fariba Kota says the Farsi broadcasts have added a new dimension to her life.
Oh, I became a Lakers fan because before I never watched TV. I never watched a basketball game. But since radio started to have it in the Farsi, I'm watching TV and I'm listening to the radio.
Sia Maxibatamani watches Lakers games with his dad, who speaks only Farsi.
But now that we listen to it in Farsi and watch it on TV, he gets more of a sense of who the players are and who the opposite team is, and it does bring families together.
That sense of unity is more important now, he says, after so many local Iranians were forced last month to register with the Immigration and Naturalization Service and subsequently jailed. This is the first full season for Farsi language broadcasts of Lakers games, and the Lakers' new English language announcer, Paul Sunderland. He's taken over for the legendary Chick Hearn, who died last August after broadcasting Lakers games for 42 years. Hearn's widow, Marge, believes Chick would have enjoyed hearing Lakers games in Farsi, even though he always had trouble with foreign languages.
I think he'd have a lot of fun with it, but he never could understand languages. I mean, every place we went in Europe, he'd always say, Marge, what is he saying? I mean.
And reaching out to more Iranian listeners would please the Lakers' 7 foot 2 inch tall, 300-pound center, Shaquille O'Neal.
Hello. I love you. Peace. As-salamu alaykum.
For Only a Game, I'm Steve Julian in Los Angeles.
Shaquille O'Neal که به بازی برگشته ریباند رو میگیره برای اوری. خودش میره تو در زمین هورنتس برای کوبی. کوبی برای دیوین جورج. حالا برای شک در پست، چرخش در برابر الدن کمبل، دوست قدیمی خودش که یک بار در غیاب شک بازی کرد و 40 امتیاز گرفت الدن کمبل برای لیکرز.
It's 18 minutes past the hour. And now for a boring sports story. Students at a sports center at Bonn University in Germany were interrupted mid-workout when four wild boars came rumbling into the facility. The beasts crashed through a window and charged from one room to another, damaging sports equipment and several glass doors in the process. Bonn University gardener Thomas Kiel said, "I ran in to see what was happening and had to throw myself into a doorway when a huge boar came charging at me." That dramatic and original acrobatic feat of boar dodging burned nearly 400 calories. But there is no indication Mr. Kiel thinks that it will catch on with those anticipating the next trend in aerobics.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. For the latest sports scores and headlines, go to WBUR.org, click on News, and then Sports. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Innuendo, offering unique window coverings and featuring the complete Hunter Douglas collection, including Duet, Silhouette, and Luminette shadings. Hunter Douglas at Innuendo, Route 9 in Natick. The Waldorf School in Lexington, serving grades N through 12, holding a high school open house on January 25th, 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. Information and philosophy at thewaldorfschool.org. And Sophos Antivirus, protecting corporate IT networks worldwide for 15 years with multi-platform protection on servers, desktops, and mobile devices. SOPHOS.com. It's 1 degree in Boston, sunny and cold. The forecast today, highs 15 to 20. Overnight becoming mostly cloudy, lows in the teens, a chance of snow on Sunday, highs 25 to 30. It's 7:20, this is WBUR.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, Charlie Pierce motors in his Renault LeCar to talk about LeBron's Humvee. But first, while involved in the production of the Golden Voices of Baseball, Ted Patterson must have had a hard time convincing his friends that he was working. The book and the two compact discs accompanying it tell the stories and include the voices of some of baseball's most accomplished play-by-play announcers. Some of the men who chronicled the doings of generations of ballplayers were superb storytellers, and they became more popular than the players themselves. Ted Patterson joins me now from WCBM in Baltimore. Welcome to Only a Game.
Great to be with you, Bill.
Talking to these guys and collecting the stories of the men no longer available for conversations, this really wasn't work, was it?
No, it was a labor of love. I've always enjoyed history, especially sports history, and the fact that when I was in college and started working at the radio station and had to do a project, it just was a natural fit to delve into the early days of radio and the pioneers, the trailblazers, who carved the trail of sports broadcasting, and I found out that there really hadn't been a whole lot recorded. It all came together back, believe it or not, in the mid to late 60s. So we might have a record here for the longest in between writing a book and having it published.
Many of the pioneers of baseball broadcasting have terrific stories of how they got their first jobs. Tom Red Manning was brought into a local radio station to announce the scores of the games after the radio announcers, who were the regular guys, kept pronouncing the names of the players wrong.
So they decided that they would take the fellow with a megaphone, who was this old redhead, and perhaps he would be able to pronounce the names. But I finally went down to WJAY, and as I sat in front of the microphone, I thought the reason they wanted Tom Manning, the old redhead, is because I had a loud voice. I was the megaphone man. So as I sat at the microphone, the red light came on, I took a deep breath, and I blew the station off the air for about an hour.
These guys, some of them, really didn't know what they were doing when this whole thing began, did they?
No, because it was so new. Tom had been the megaphone man at League Park and had been used to bellowing as loud as he could. They would wear tuxedos to remotes, even though we're talking radio. Nobody was watching them. They did a lot of strange things. It was just trial and error and establishing a profession. And so many of them, as you mentioned, were either sports writers or answered an ad or something like that, or joined a contest for announcers. One guy was Franz Laux, became a legend in St. Louis, was just walking down a street, and this fellow named Yates pulled over in his Model T and said, "Have you ever done anything on radio?" And he said, "No, but I'd like to try." And he had all of 90 seconds to prepare to do the 1927 World Series.
Yeah, I love that one. I also love the guy who was staying in a hotel, and he saw a long line of guys, and he figured, what the heck, and got in it. And it turned out to be a contest for somebody who was going to be the baseball announcer there.
Yeah, and that was Bob Elson, the commander, who's one of the great broadcasters in broadcasting history as far as baseball. Over 40 years with the White Sox and the Cubs. Yeah, he was just on a vacation and did it as a lark just to see what a radio station looked like, and ended up winning this contest and kind of felt bad because he really didn't care that one way or the other. And this other fellow who he beat out was really gung-ho and really was disappointed.
We should mention, for folks who only listen to live broadcasts these days, that not all the games were live in the old days. Lindsey Nelson describes here recreating games for the Liberty Broadcasting System.
We'd have a staff announcer assigned to every game, and we had set up a system whereby we created our own public address. We did this with an echo chamber. The echo chamber, strangely enough, was the men's room, and the engineer had set up a system in the men's room where he'd get the echo. So for the duration of each recreation, the men's room was closed. We had to put a sign on it. And so when a new pitcher was coming in, the staff announcer would go into the studio next and say, "Young ladies and gentlemen, coming in to pitch for the New York Yankees, so-and-so. And we'd have him throughout the game say, "Ladies and gentlemen, will those of you in the front rows remove your jackets from the railing?" And, you know, the things you hear at a ballpark.
Largely due to Gordon McClendon's penchant for using Tom Wolfe quotes in his game descriptions, Liberty's recreations have been described in The New Yorker as, quote, "the final flowering of a poetic age." Would you agree with that?
I really would, because they went to great lengths to capture the flavor of baseball and their descriptions. And the beauty of recreations, you had time to actually deliver the product. There's so many great stories emanating from these recreations. They were in a studio with a little ticker and a Western Union operator, and that was it. And they'd have to tell a story, weave a tale of the game. You know, just looking at a wall, you know, they'd have different guys on different bases. And there were so many stories about breakdowns in the system. And then they'd have to have a guy, a player, fouling off a ball about eight times to get it back just to stall for time.
On the other end of the literary spectrum of the broadcaster as artist was Dizzy Dean, a former ball player who took more than a little ribbing for his lack of grammatical sensibility.
What if I did say he slid into third, or he was throwed out at second? Besides, where do folks get off criticizing my grammar? Chuck's only went up to the second grade, and if I'd have gone up to the third, I'd have passed my old man.
It's a little hard to imagine somebody who only got through the second grade getting a job in broadcasting today, I guess.
That's right. He was in a class by himself, and as Buddy Blattner explains, who worked with Dizzy, what would you expect from somebody named Dizzy other than to be a little goofy? And one of the great segments of the CDs is the one where Dizzy worked with Buddy just a couple of months before he died. Dizzy was, you know, just in rare form that night, too.
There's a long shot. It's going to be, I believe. The Giants win the pennant. The Giants win the pennant. The Giants win the pennant.
That, of course, is Russ Hodges with one of the most well-known baseball calls of all time, which is a little ironic considering that the call was recorded only by luck and coincidence. Can you tell the story of how Russ Hodges came to be in possession of a recording of that call?
Right, and Russ talks about it on the CD also, as he talks about that whole pennant race, that miracle comeback season. Russ did the game, WMCA in New York, and of course the windup was the most magical call of all time. And after it was all over and the emotion had calmed down a little bit, he thought, gee, wouldn't it be great to have a copy of that? And he talked to the station engineer. And they said, Russ, we didn't record it. It's not there. So he thought, oh, boy, that's too bad. I really would have liked to have had that. And then he went home, and later that evening he got a phone call. And it was from a man in Brooklyn. And Russ thought he was just looking for tickets to the World Series. And he says, well, I'll talk to him. And as it turned out, his name was Lawrence Goldberg. He was a waiter in a downtown New York restaurant. And he had just gotten this newfangled contraption called a tape recorder. And they were talking now 1951, and not too many people had these. But he was home after he had gotten the present, and they were taping the grandchildren and Aunt Ethel. And then all of a sudden, they were listening to the baseball game in the background. And he says, well, let's see how this turns out. And he put the microphone up to the radio. And fortunately, that game thus was preserved, that windup. That great finish, if it wasn't for Lawrence Goldberg, and Russ said neither of them really got anything monetarily beneficial out of it. They made a record album, Chesterfield, the cigarette company, and Russ got a couple of cartons of cigarettes, which didn't do him any good because he was only 60 when he passed away, unfortunately. But just a little bit of happenstance there and a little bit of good luck.
Red Barber is an announcer particularly dear to the hearts of lots of public radio listeners who remember his weekly conversations with Morning Edition's Bob Edwards long after Red retired from broadcasting baseball.
Hodges is a magnificent athletic specimen. I don't know of anybody who has ever seen him that wants any part of it. And he's awfully good-natured, which everybody says is just grand. But if you're that strong, you ought to be good-natured. Fastball inside on the short ribs. Saves him up again. One ball, one strike.
Despite his laid-back Southern style, Red is known as the first broadcaster to break the ban on radio baseball broadcasts in New York.
A lot of teams felt that radio was giving the public something for nothing and was going to cost them at the gate, which was the exact opposite of what happened, because people like Red Barber and all these other announcers became household names in the public's eye. Everybody had radios after a while, and a whole new audience of housewives, for one, and kids were established just from radio that they didn't have before. And it forced people to be more interested and go to ball games. And the New York teams were the last to actually break down and admit that broadcasting was a benefit. And we're talking now 1939, so this is the biggest city in the country not having any broadcast of their games for years and years while everybody else was doing it, most of the teams anyway.
It explains in part why some of those early broadcasters used to say, plenty of good seats still available.
Right, and some of these announcers in different towns, Ty Tyson in Detroit, in Cleveland, of course, Jack Graney, you could walk home from school and listen to the game the whole way home because people would have it in their living rooms. And in the Chicago days, in the 20s, it was really wild because there were no such things as rights fees. So every station that wanted to do the game could do it. And they had five different broadcasters doing the same game at the same time on five different stations.
Of Harry Carey, late of the Cardinals, White Sox, and Cubs, you write, quote, "Baseball was a stage that saw him become bigger than some of the teams he talked about." Did that happen with other announcers or any other announcer to the extent that it happened with Harry Carey?
I think in a different way. He wasn't as demonstrative or as exuberant. In Pittsburgh, Rosie Rosewell became a beloved character. He had these colorful sayings, "Raise the window, Aunt Minnie," "Here she comes" when there was a home run. And then later on, Bob Prince became equally renowned in Pittsburgh and beloved. They called him the Gunner, and he was just one of those unique characters that have disappeared from the scene. Bill, of the 35 or 40 men that I interviewed for this book and had their stories on tape, only one now is still doing what he did then, and that's Vin Scully.
Anybody who's been a baseball fan for any length of time has a favorite announcer. One of my favorites is Jim Woods. I heard him in New York and then later in Boston. He's one of the many announcers who worked with Mel Allen.
I'll never forget one of the first exhibition games we ever worked, Ted, in St. Petersburg. Mantle was the hitter, and I was describing the inning, and Mel had the habit, when he said something that displeased him, the fingers popped, and he knew you'd said something he didn't like. And I said, "Mantle swings, there's a foul back on top." And the fingers started to snap, and I looked at Mel, and I said, "What?" He said, "On top of what?" I looked at him, and I said, "The roof." He said, "Then say the roof. Complete your sentence."
Woods was distinguished in part by the fact that throughout his long career, he never became the so-called number one guy. He was just happier as a sidekick, I guess, because he must have had the opportunities.
Yeah, he was a fellow that loved going to the racetrack and just loved being in baseball and loved everything about it, and worked with Bob Prince for years and years and several other top broadcasters, and was always the second banana. And I thought he just had a great talent. Listening to him do play-by-play was riveting.
See, I used to root for rain delays when it was Martin and Woods doing the Red Sox, because their stories that they told during the rain delays were often more entertaining than the brand of ball the Red Sox were playing at that point.
Right, and the same thing holds true in Cincinnati, where Wade Hoyt was the broadcaster for 25 years, and they prayed for rain because Waite would then talk about Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig and relate all these great stories of when he was on the Yankees back in the 20s. And today you've got a lot of ex-players, but I don't know how many stories they have. It's just a different time we live in.
Ted Patterson is the author of The Golden Voices of Baseball from Sports Publishing. Ted, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you very much, Bill. Enjoyed it.
Turn it up louder, the pictures are coming in fine. And it's play by play on the radio. Play by play on the radio. Play by play. Yesterday and today. Play by play, I saw it.
You're listening to Only a Game. We're still fielding congratulations for the rutabaga curling piece we ran 2 weeks ago. Howard Bennett, who hears Only a Game on WHYY in Philadelphia, wrote, "I especially appreciated the person getting caught disguising a black radish as a rutabaga. I wonder if a regular turnip would pass muster." Following our expose of the latest exercise craze, cardio striptease, in last week's show, a Massachusetts listener who wishes to be identified only as Clint asked for the name of the, quote, hot tune playing behind the piece. We answered him. It was the Lonely G-String, and nobody here asked why he'd inquired. In response to last week's commentary about the Washington University basketball players who saved their teammate's life with CPR, even though they weren't sure how to administer the treatment, Carolyn Roosevelt, a WBUR listener, wrote, considering the many hundreds of hours student athletes across America put in each year for their sports, I wonder if teams might be encouraged to devote 4 or 5 of those hours to actually learning and practicing CPR, perhaps treating it as a team public service project. John Wild of Greenwood, South Carolina, emailed to say we'd missed a good opportunity by failing to follow our mention of the so-called beer wenches at Australian cricket matches with a song entitled The Pub with No Beer. Brian Maline, who identifies himself as a fellow who first found the show while driving to the Minneapolis Rowing Club early on Saturday morning, was moved by writer Bill Plaschke's account of Sarah Morris, the disabled young woman who laboriously types her accounts of Dodger games with a stylus attached to her head. She should be an inspiration to us all, he wrote. If she could accomplish all that, given her circumstances, none of the rest of us has any obstacles to our own dreams. Finally, Bob Carl of Coronado, California, wrote to say, no one has been able to tell me when or where the first flip turn was seen at a major swim meet. Did it cause a furor among the judges? Did it take everyone by surprise? Did the flip turner win? If you know, tell us, and we'll pass the answer on to Mr. Carl via the website, onlyagame.org. You can reach us through that website or by emailing us at oag@wbur.bu.edu. We live at 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215, and you can leave a message on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston, where Only a Game is produced, and from the other NPR member stations airing this program. Additional support comes from Thermo Electron, the scientific instruments company with a mission to advance drug discovery, improve manufacturing, and protect people and the environment, on the web at thermo.com. And from Nutter, McLennan, and Fish, working to solve critical legal issues on local, national, and international levels. Information at Nutter.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Wellington Management Company, providing investment advice to clients worldwide. Mount Auburn Club, Health Racket Club and Spa, celebrating more than 28 years of fitness education support and results. Mount Auburn Club, full of life, mountauburnclub.com. And Jordan's Furniture, furnishing houses and creating homes and families in partnership with Massachusetts Adoption Resource Exchange. Information at 617-54-ADOPT. Good morning, I'm Bob C., and in sports headlines, the Celtics blew a 14-point lead last night and came back to defeat the Indiana Pacers by a score of 98-93. Paul Pierce scored 31 points for Boston, while Antoine Walker had 31 points and 10 rebounds. The Celtics' win ended the Pacers' 5-game winning streak. Meanwhile, the slumping Bruins lost again last night by a score of 3-1 to the Atlanta Thrashers. The Bruins have gone 3-14-1 over their last 18 games. Environmental journalist Dan Grossman is filing reports from Antarctica exclusively for WBUR.org all this month. Log on today and see a narrated 5-day time-lapse video of a passing storm that damaged the roof of Dan's outpost. That's only at WBUR.org. It's a bit like Antarctica in Boston this morning. 1 degree, sunny and cold the forecast today, highs 15 to 20. A chance of some light snow on Cape Cod continuing this morning. Tomorrow, a chance of snow with highs 25 to 30.
What better way to start off the new year than with a free laptop computer from WBUR? For a limited time, your $100 pledge for the news will also enter your name in a drawing to win a brand new Apple G3 laptop, courtesy of Tech Superpowers, technology for genius. Start the new year with a pledge for the news that could put a brand new laptop computer in your hands. Enter now on the web at WBUR.org, and good luck.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, the not-so-mystical significance of two basketball numbers, 800 and 54. But first, our analyst Charlie Pierce joins me for some discussion of the sports news of the week. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
Let's begin with football.
Of course, because you're the host of the show.
The participants in the Super Bowl will emerge from tomorrow's games, and they will be...
See, I'm really on the horns of the dilemma here.
I think it's going to be Oakland and Philadelphia. I want it to be Tennessee and Tampa. I mean, in the year in which Johnny Unitas passed away, Steve McNair of the Tennessee Titans is the new Johnny Unitas. He doesn't practice. I guess he started practicing this week. Last week during the game against Pittsburgh, he had to, quote, have the skin trimmed from the first knuckle because he hit his throwing hand on a helmet. The guy has played through more injuries and more pain than any player in the league. I really wanted to get back to the Super Bowl because he only fell a yard short against St. Louis the one time he was there. I think Tennessee is just too injured to beat the Raiders. And I think Tampa will lose to Philadelphia on the grounds that they don't want to be the team that beats the Eagles in the last game ever played in Veterans Stadium because there won't be enough of them, you know, to be identified by dental records enough to play in the Super Bowl.
The 31-6 loss which the San Francisco 49ers suffered in the NFC Divisional Playoffs last week was enough to bounce 49er coach Steve Mariucci from his job. Philosophical differences between coach and owner were cited. I know you've heard that phrase before. What clashing philosophies do you suppose were involved here?
Well, as you know, Steve is a longtime logical positivist. And Terry Donahue, the general manager, is a bit more of an existentialist, having spent time on the Riviera with Sartre and Simone de Beauvoir. Now, what that means is Mariucci got sick of having retired genius Bill Walsh looking over his shoulder every time he made a move. They will bring in some very pliable, unemployed guy like Dennis Green. And the 49ers will go blissfully on, winning 9 or 10 games a year and losing the first or second round of the playoffs.
The Cincinnati Bengals, a team that hasn't managed a winning season in 12 years, hired Marvin Lewis as their head coach on Tuesday. It's not really fair, is it? The rare hiring of an African-American head coach, and he has to run the Bengals?
Marvin Lewis always said he wanted an NFL job in the worst way. And by God, Bill, he got one. He has no chance. As long as Mike Brown owns the Cincinnati Bengals, no coach has a chance. He will turn them around, I think, in the short term because Cincinnati's got some players, and they are a very talented young defensive team. So Marvin Lewis may step in and win 7-8 games next year, but in the long term, he will find his position as untenable as anybody who's ever coached the Cincinnati Bengals is.
The Big Tuna may reel former Cowboys quarterback Troy Aikman back to Dallas. This can't possibly be a good idea, can it?
Anybody who encourages Troy Aikman to do this, any agent who writes him a contract, and Bill Parcells if he puts him on the field, should all be ashamed of themselves. Troy Aikman is one concussion away from playing with his food with his feet. There is absolutely no reason for this. I don't care how much he wants to play. I don't care how many older quarterbacks are doing well. This guy should be put in a position where he can think when he's 60. And anybody that aids or abets this fiasco deserves what they get. And I hope what they get is a lot of guilt.
The Buffalo Sabres are apparently broke. The team filed for bankruptcy on Monday, and three players who haven't been paid may become free agents. Why only three?
Apparently because they're the only three Sabres who are owed deferred money. It's Curtis Brown, a defenseman named Jay McKee, and another defenseman named Brian Campbell. I don't see a way out of this for the league and the Sabres. Unless these guys are willing to take one for the team, they're going to become wealthier guys sometime in the next 90 days.
The Ottawa Senators are also facing a crisis. They filed for bankruptcy last week. Is it time for the NHL to start shedding franchises?
Ottawa is still an enormously successful franchise. It's just that the people who own it haven't paid their bills. They're competitively terrific. They draw pretty good crowds to very good crowds at the Correll Center. You still have to wonder, given the fact that we are going to be heading into a bloody collective bargaining process here in the NHL, how much of this is posturing and how much of this is positioning?
Elsewhere in hockey, Charlie, in Finland, to be precise, Canadian Olympic star Haley Wickenheiser became the first woman to score a point in a men's pro game when she got an assist for the second division team that's employing her. Ms. Wickenheiser's presence on the roster apparently resulted in a standing-room-only crowd, fairly unusual for a minor league hockey game, as I understand it.
The announced sellout crowd of 1,200 in Kirkkonummi, which is a lovely, pleasant place to get your first goal. Unfortunately, Haley did score an own goal later in the game.
Game went on too long.
where it bounced into her own net. I suspect there was a standing boo at that point.
At the Australian Open, Venus Williams played well enough in the early going to motivate her sister, who said, hey, it looks like Venus wants to be number one again. I better get going. She'll be going after something called the Serena Slam, at least by some writers. Serena has said that winning this major will be, quote, really tough. Any reason why we should believe her?
Absolutely not. She's head and shoulders above everyone else in the women's field. Martina Hingis this week announced that her career may be over because of foot injuries. There's nobody rising through the junior ranks to challenge her. And frankly, she's far enough ahead of Venus that Venus is getting concerned. I just wish we didn't have this Serena Slam thing. We had the Tiger Slam in golf. The Grand Slam has been good enough for everybody for 50 years.
Mm-hmm.
or 100 years, or 150 years. Let's just have the Grand Slam. I'm not going to get excited about marketing devices.
Remarkable hot stove league development this week, Charlie. Pete Rose was nominated for the Hall of Fame.
Yes, the Canadian Baseball Hall of Fame, which I didn't even know existed, by the way. There is a 16-member committee that's going to be evaluating the nomination of Rose and 45 others. People may have forgotten that Pete actually played part of the 1984 season with the Montreal Expos, and I am sure that in his basement, he has every baseball he hit for a base hit during his brief time with the Expos and would be willing to part with them to the Canadian Hall of Fame at a reasonable price. American, of course, and not Canadian.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Globe Sunday Magazine, and you can see him on your radio each week here at Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Phil.
On this week's stories, pictures from stories past and present, commentaries galore, and the opportunity to write email to us, check out our website, onlyagame.org. On Tuesday night, for the 800th time, a Pat Summitt-coached University of Tennessee team won a basketball game. Coach Summitt joined Dean Smith, Adolph Rupp, and Jim Phelan as one of the only Division I coaches to have achieved 800 wins. She joins me now on the line from her home in Knoxville, Tennessee. Pat, I understand that the roses, the cake, the game ball were all presented to you right after win number 800, but please accept only a game's congratulations now.
Thank you, Bill. It was certainly great to accomplish this in front of all of our fans, because they've just been outstanding.
I understand that you began coaching the Tennessee team when you were 22 years old. Given the way the landscape of women's basketball has changed, how likely is it that a 22-year-old would get an opportunity to be a head coach these days?
Wouldn't even get an interview, much less have a chance to get a job. I had obviously no credentials other than being a player, but you always hear life's a lot about timing, and obviously for Pat Summitt, it was great timing.
You have recruited and developed some spectacular players, building the teams that you've built to win 800 games. Roughly how many of those players have stayed in the game to become coaches?
At one time we had 29, I would say, around 30.
Wow. So your influence on the game has been spreading out all over the place. It's very exciting.
It is exciting. I think with our players deciding they want to stay in the game and obviously want to pursue the coaching profession, I do feel that that's a reflection of their experiences with our staff here at Tennessee, and we've had a lot of consistency. I have two assistants that are in their 18th year. So I think that certainly has allowed us to be able to produce some players that feel like they leave here and know the game and all aspects of it.
I've read that you have said you have more goals to achieve, which is not surprising. A seventh national championship would be among those goals. Have you begun thinking about former UCLA coach John Wooden's 10 titles as a mark to shoot for?
No, actually, I spoke with Coach Wooden yesterday and told Coach Wooden that we had a chance to visit with him, and I just can't imagine what he was able to accomplish and do it in grace and style. And he's such a humble individual. But will that ever be matched? I don't anticipate that it ever will be. But certainly, as we think about our goals here at Tennessee, we're just looking for one more.
Always one more, though.
Always.
Gone are the days when folks could be pretty sure that one of a small handful of women's teams would win the NCAA championship. Are you happy to see how many very strong women's teams there are now, or do you miss the days when it always seemed to be either Tennessee and Connecticut or Connecticut and Tennessee?
You know, quite honestly, I'm excited about the parity. I think the parity speaks to the growth of women's basketball and the popularity. I think the fact that we have so many outstanding teams, we're seeing our fan base of those respective teams pick up. We're seeing television from coast to coast and a lot of new faces and new names to the game. And that's all I feel really healthy and good as we continue to grow our sport.
Jody Conrad, the coach at Texas, is just a few wins behind you. Have you made plans to send her a telegram or anything, maybe have dinner together so the winners of 1,600 games can be photographed together?
Well, Jody and I are friends and have been friends over the years. And actually, she held me back a little bit because we've lost to Texas the last two outings. But certainly I will give Jody my congratulations when she reaches this milestone in really in probably within the next week or so.
As you say, Tennessee lost to Texas. Tennessee also lost to UConn. You're 12-3 now, but you have a reputation for building teams up and getting them ready for March. What are your chances this time around in the NCAA tournament?
I like this team. I like their chances because they are very, very talented. They have a good chemistry. They seem to be really focused on daily improvement. And with the schedule we're playing, I think that it's ideal. They will have seen a lot of the best teams in the country and a lot of different styles of play. And certainly they'll be road tested and hopefully they'll be ready for March Madness.
Pat Summitt, the most recent coach to join basketball's Elite 800 Club. Pat, again, congratulations and thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you. I enjoyed speaking with you.
The second remarkable basketball number in the news this week is much smaller than 800. It's only 54. On Wednesday night, with its 54th win in a row, the University of Connecticut women's team, coached by Gino Auriemma, tied the record for consecutive wins by a Division I women's team. If UConn, playing at home, beats Georgetown tonight, the Huskies will pass the Louisiana Tech team that won 54 in a row from 1980 through 1982. Joining me now to discuss, among other things, the near inevitability of that is Jeff Goldberg, who covers UConn basketball for the Hartford Courant. Jeff, welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks for having me on.
I understand that Coach Auriemma has been very reluctant to discuss the streak. Is he superstitious or does he just have other things on his mind?
I think he pretty much has other things on his mind. I don't think it's a matter of superstition with him. In fact, he's often been a great appreciator of historical events in sports and out of sports. So I think probably in the deep recesses of his mind, this is a big deal. But he is having enough trouble just getting this team from game to game. Certainly in the last week or so, when everyone else wants to talk about the streak, the team has come close to losing three of the last four games.
Mm-hmm.
So he's really worried about just the day-to-day, getting these guys prepared for each game and trying to survive the games. So he's thinking one game at a time, quite literally.
Last year, UConn was undefeated, 39-0. Four of the graduating seniors were first-round picks in the WNBA draft. This year's team has gone 15-0 with Diana Taurasi and the youth movement. I wonder if this year's performance so far is actually more impressive than last year's, given the cast of characters.
Yeah, in a way it is. I mean, certainly last year, there was really no doubt going into each game that UConn was going to win. They only had one game really all season long at Virginia Tech where there was a chance they could lose. It was tied with about 3 minutes to go. And this year's team, I mean, they've incorporated four freshmen, one of whom is hurt right now, Nicole Wolf. So they really had to reinvent themselves. I mean, it's a completely different team. Sometimes it's Diana carrying them, but then there are nights like Wednesday night against Seton Hall where she really didn't shoot well. She was 1-for-12, and it was some of the freshmen, Wilnette Crockett and Barbara Turner, that had to come through and deliver them the victory. So, yeah, it's been much more difficult for them to be undefeated at this point in this season. And again, they certainly probably should have lost to Tennessee about a week and a half ago. They were down 8 with about 3 minutes to go and found a way to win that game in overtime. So there's a lot of suspense with it, and they've really had to find new ways to get things done.
Coach Auriemma frequently gets the players he wants when he goes recruiting. Winning national championships will do that for you. But he said to you recently, I've seen teams with the best players lose. What's the likelihood that Georgetown wins tonight?
A couple weeks ago I would have said almost no chance. I think we would have said that Seton Hall had no chance on Wednesday, and then there was a two-point game with about a minute and a half to go. I mean, UConn should certainly beat Georgetown, especially at home at the Civic Center. with what's at stake. But nothing's really a given with this team this year, which is what's a little unusual for the folks in this part of the world. There are no automatic 30-point blowout victories like there have been. But I would expect that they would win today. I think that would be a monumental upset if Georgetown were to win.
After Tennessee coach Pat Summitt won her 800th game a few nights ago, she was presented with a cake. She got flowers. Of course, she got the game ball. Are there any plans to commemorate UConn's record streak, assuming Geno's team prevails?
Officially, I don't know, but I suspect the players are going to have something in mind. But I think it might be more like a pie in the face for him. That's the one. Last year, he won his 450th game, and at the end of the game, the players on the bench pulled out sticks with pictures of Geno's face on them and held them up to their faces. So you had a whole row of Geno faces.
I remember that. I saw it in the paper. It was very funny.
And that's one of the things that's great about the program is that, you know, they certainly can laugh at themselves as much as they're out there trying to win games, and it's all very serious in the games. I think the team will definitely look to do something to give Geno a hard time to repay him for all his love and practice.
Jeff Goldberg writes about the University of Connecticut women's basketball team for the Hartford Courant. Jeff, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is Michael Garth. We had help this week from John Hoder and from Ira Siegel at WCBM in Baltimore. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a tape of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll free. CDs and cassettes are $15 postpaid. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to hear this program again, sign up for our newsletter or mine more golden voices, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Our final word this week comes from Hartford Courant basketball writer Jeff Goldberg.
I am in the process of putting together a list of the 55 things interesting about the streak. So frankly, had they lost the other day, that would have been okay with me.
Jeff, just be glad your task isn't to find 55 interesting things to say about coal mining, digging ditches, or flipping burgers. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants, offering discerning patients a same-day tooth replacement solution for failed root canal treated or missing teeth. Information is available online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is W.
National Public Radio.
This is W.